You are listening to the Sounds of the Bazaar. Maxwell welcoming you to the 2008 series of Sounds of the Bazaar. We've taken a bit of a gap since our last broadcast. We've been thinking about the format and the future of Sounds of the Bazaar. As I guess if you're a regular listener, you know, Sounds of the Bazaar was funded and sponsored by the European Bazaar Project, www.bazaar.org. Well, that project came to its end of its funding period at the end of December 2007, and we'd be thinking about how we're going to develop and continue the programme into the future, because we're not dropping it. Just because the funding's gone, Sounds of the Bazaar isn't going to go away, and it's going to continue to be produced by Pontardusky. And of course, Pontardusky, as some of you will know, has launched its own website, and we're thinking how Sounds of the Bazaar can become a regular focus in our website. Now, for the 2008 series, we are going to make a few changes and innovations in our programme format. We've been doing a bit of a poll of our listeners. Nothing scientific, you understand, more like nattering to people in pubs. And a few things have come out. Firstly, people quite like short podcasts, the sort of thing I think George Roberts once said, it's good to be able to listen to something at lunchtime. So we're going to produce more of the sort of 10-minute to 15-minute slots, which you can listen to in the car going into work in the morning, listen to at your lunchtime or during break. And those will be coming out on topical issues mainly, mainly much picking up people where I find them and talking to them about the things that interest them. And then there's a second format we're going to do, and that's due to my particular interest, I suppose. I got very interested in practice. What makes for successful practice in e-learning? And I've been looking at all the handbooks and all the web guides and all that stuff. And it didn't really convince me of why something succeeds and something doesn't. So we're going to try and start looking at practice in successful learning. And that's going to be doing a series of interviews with people, perhaps features and websites as well, things we think is great. And for the first issue, I'm very happy to say, we got an interview with Helen Keegan. Now, she'll be coming on after the break. Don't go away. We're not dropping our musical interludes anyway. Dirk Stieglitz is going to be spinning those records around and doing the mixes. So, back with Helen in a moment. Interested in just what makes for effective practice in using ICT for learning in education, and particularly Web 2.0. Yes, I know we've got plenty of books on the subject, and of course we've got instructional design. Instructional design, said Wikipedia, is the practice of arranging media and content to help learners and teachers transfer knowledge most effectively. The process consists of determining the current state of understanding, defining the end goals of the instruction, delivering the end goal of the instruction, and creating some media-based intervention to assist in transition. All very neat and logical, but does learning really happen like this in the real world? And of course, it's terribly teacher-driven. The teacher or instructional designer works out what the learner needs and provides it. Not much room for exploration, for creating, for emotions, and that's all the things I associate with Web 2.0. So what are the alternatives? Well, yes, there's learning design. At least learning design gets at the process of learning, but it's still teacher-driven and the tools have never really worked. Yet every week I come across stories of great teaching and learning, exciting stories, stories that make me want to know more. So I thought in this series, The Sounds of the Bazaar, I would record some of those stories and try to explore from the bottom up, if you like, what really makes such learning effective. Now, the first of these stories is from Helen Keegan. Helen Keegan is a teacher and researcher at the University of Salford in Manchester in the UK. She's been developing a new course module for final year students on a professional sounds and video degree. The aim of the degree, or the aim of the module, is to develop the student's ability to produce high-quality multimedia for print-based and computer-based applications. Helen was concerned that while the students were technically competent and were aware of and used Web 2.0 tools, they did not really understand the implications of the new approaches to web design and development.
And they were all on MySpace. And all hearing artists on MySpace, but without any real understanding of how they can make that work for them. So it was very much looking at that and thinking about things like, you know, the long tail and sort of niche publishing, democratisation of the internet, the read-write web. Naturally, when we're teaching people sort of applications, it's inevitably quite instructivist, you know. And as I say, I mean, I've always believed that once you've learnt, you know, a few applications, it gets much easier to then learn more. And I felt like, you know, we've done applications, let's, you know. And it was, a lot of it was to do with professionalising them. That was the big thing. You know, the final year students wanted to really sort of get them clued up about what's really going on out there on the net and how that will impact them as audio and video professionals. So there's a lot of work looking at you know, content mashups and copyright and licensing, Creative Commons, all that type of thing. You know, as I say, they all go and illegally download music or look at things on YouTube, but they don't really engage with, well, how is this going to affect me as a professional? How am I going to feel as a professional when someone downloads my music? You know, that kind of thing. So it was quite discursive, really.
So Helen had done a needs analysis. She'd worked out what she thought the students needed to learn about and thought something about the contents. But how did she translate that into activity?
I split the module. It's a 12-week module. And I split it into two halves. First half of the module was all based on individual work. Second half of the module, all based on group work. So first half of the module, introduced it by talking about, you know, the old web and the new web. So web 1 versus web 2, all the concepts there. And then basically the next few weeks were spent developing what I called my digital self, which is probably pretty close to an e-portfolio. But I think the semantics were quite significant there. But yeah, the first half, it was all looking at issues of, well, basically it was, first of all, professionalising them and their presence online. So getting them to design their own websites, well, website headers, business cards. So a lot of, you know, the first couple of weeks just on design principles and designing. Then we moved on to blogging on the WordPress platform. And then we went quite deeply into the presentation of the self in the digital environment, digital identity. And then on a practical level, what happens when you Google yourself? All right, how are you going to fix it? By, for instance, running a blog and having an authoritative voice and a Flickr account where you put pictures up, you can actually make sure that that's what comes up for the first few pages of a Google search. And it's quite common sense stuff.
So there's a few things emerging here. Yes, this is a taught course. Yes, there's learning objectives. Yes, there's a needs analysis. But this is as much about students expressing their own identities, their own feelings, as it's about learning preset objectives. And of course, for that, they're using Web 2.0 tools just as much as they're using formal learning materials to allow students their own voice and their own expression. Helen went on to tell me how they'd used video in the course.
So we then moved on to through the digital presence side of things, moved on to online CV production. So the idea was they'd have this professional business card, and then they could just give that to people. They'd go onto the website, see the matching header, online CV, work showcase site. So as I say, the stuff that they had on MySpace, it was quite unsuitable as an environment, and get them to bring it over. So it was a really nice sort of showcase of their work, everything that they did, recognising not just qualifications, but stuff that they did outside of the university, which again was very important. They really, really enjoyed doing that. I had them all set up Flickr accounts and obviously YouTube to bring things into it. With YouTube, we talked, you know, about the sort of technical side of video production on YouTube, because that's very important for them to know. You know, certain MPEG-4 codec that is ideally suited for the purpose, but because YouTube isn't a sort of, you know, a traditional broadcast medium, again, it's not something they're actually taught, and yet it's very, very important, because it's probably where most videos are being released, you know. It's just very practical stuff like that. And in terms of, you know, the digital identity and digital presence, we then moved on to looking at content mashups and Creative Commons licensing. Really interesting example there, because I talked to them about the famous case of Star Wars Kid, which was the huge viral success on YouTube with the French-Canadian schoolboy playing with a lightsaber. His friends found a video, released it onto YouTube. Within a few weeks, it had something ridiculous like 9 million hits and became a global phenomenon, to the point where I think the last count, I think about 6 American TV series had actually brought Star Wars Kid into the TV series as a character. So it came full circle, you know, this internet phenomenon, to the point where even George Lucas got involved. But that was a really interesting case, because, you know, it's so well known and famous, but ultimately this is a video that this kid had made and put in the back of a cupboard, and someone had found it and put it on the internet, and he became global property in a sense. His parents took the families of the kids involved to court, so there's a very big legal case around that. But that was a great way to talk to them about copyright, licensing, identity and content mashups, because people are remaking this video and putting it back onto YouTube. Well, the good thing about that was it was something that they all knew about, and it was something that they all found pretty funny, but they'd never had to think about it seriously before. So by using real world examples to sort of illustrate these points, that really, really, really helped. So all the time we're always relating things back to what they'd know. And so I think it was quite powerful in that respect. The final part of that was 2 blog posts which they were asked to write. None of them had ever blogged before. And I think the first one I asked them to write a sort of critically reflective account on an article called The New Web. And then the other one, I gave them 2 articles. One was pro Web 2 in the broadcast industries, and one was anti Web 2 in the broadcast industries. And then I gave them, a Guardian editorial, which was talking about the deal that had been struck between Last.fm and Sony BMG to distribute content. So I gave them this very pro, very anti stance, and then something that was kind of showing how things would come together kind of in the middle. We're going to think why people had done that and what it meant for them. So, I know, I mean, it was really interesting actually, because the first time I asked them to blog, I think the first question was, how do we write it? What style do we write it in? And it was like, is it a report? Is it an essay? And I was like, no, it's you. It's your voice. I was like, you know, relish this. You don't get many opportunities to write from the heart, unless you do, you know, an English Lit degree or something. You know, not in the sciences anyway. So I was really impressed by the standard, actually. Really, really impressed by the way that they were expressing themselves when they were given the freedom to do that. So that was the first half of the module. The second half, we then moved over to group work. I'll just mention something here. I had the framework or the structure for the module in place, but when it came to especially this group work second half, it was very, very learner-centred in that in the first week, I got them all to fill in quite a comprehensive questionnaire, asking them about basically who they were, what they did, their experiences in audio and video, what they wanted to do in the future, their use of Web 2 technologies, their use of the internet, their use of electronic devices. You know, so I got a really good picture of the directions they wanted to go in. And that was used to inform the second half of the module. As I say, it was all based on group work. And basically, what we did, they split up into groups and they worked on research projects using wikis for collaborative research. We also did something, so I've forgotten, podcasting and RSS feeds. Just thought I'd mention that. But yeah, this second half, it was group work on wikis, and again, that was really good. So finally, the last couple of weeks, few weeks, were spent working on video conferencing, both looking at the technical sides and general the netiquette involved, because rather than presenting their group projects to one another via sort of face-to-face PowerPoint, which is the traditional way, we got them to do it via web conference, which is fun. At first they hated it. When for the first time I got them web conferencing, they just weren't comfortable with it at all. But then they warmed to it very, very quickly. And so in the final week, we had them split. We had them across different rooms with, in each room, a radio mic, big amplifier, and broadcasting through to the other rooms. And it was great. And the students ran it themselves, and they asked questions to the group. So they all learned from one another's research projects. And I definitely think they engaged so much more readily because they had that kind of ownership of the web conferencing, much more than they would have done if they'd sat there and watched a group's PowerPoint presentation. So I think fundamentally the things that really jumped out at me about this, and as I said, it's just one group I've done it with, so you know, it's very early stages, but it was by loosening the control, giving them autonomy, not dictating what platforms they should use, taking a very learner-centred approach, involving them in defining their own curriculum to an extent.
Helen told me that the results have been absolutely fantastic. They did evaluation, they've had focus groups, and the feedback's been really good. And the results of students were good as well. But perhaps most encouraging for her is the fact the students have continued on over the Christmas holidays. They were emailing her and asking for more information. One of them's releasing an album, working on at the moment, and using his site as a real Web 2.0 sense to give people feedback and opinions on the tracks and on the mix, and he's developing a real community around it. And I've been looking at some of the blogs the students have created, and they're really good. But let's get on some difficult questions. We know how the course happened, but how was this designed? Was this a traditional instructional design, you know, looking at needs, working out some learning objectives, working out a media mix? Did Helen follow a different design principle, or is this something extra which we haven't got at yet, which made it such a success? Well, first I asked Helen herself whether she thought she designed it according to a traditional instructional design approach.
I followed the instructional design, I'd say, in terms of designing the framework.
Right.
But I think it's instead of rigidly defining everything that happens within that framework. Because I could go in there as a tutor and think, right, I think my students should know about this. But I need to know the students.
So, okay, how does knowing the students account for how you actually design the learning programme? How does it account for the mix if we're saying this is a blended learning programme?
One of the sort of almost potentially restrictive factors was that it was 9 to 11 on a Monday morning. Now, bearing in mind, probably half of this group are DJs or they work in studios. They tend to go to bed rather late. You know, 9 on a Monday morning is not a good time for them. So And I was aware of that because I've taught at that time for years. And so what I did, I kind of made a rule to myself. I didn't tell them this, but I had my 20-minute rule, which was we wouldn't do anything for more than 20 minutes. Never told them that, but it really worked. So, you know, sort of start off, like, and I used a lot of YouTube, not just once or twice in a two-hour session, but each session, just to break things up and liven things up. So, you know, first thing in the morning, we'd start with a snappy YouTube video and then go into discussion. And it was amazing how in-depth you could get without people resisting it or realising it, because they'd had this kind of, you know, mixed up, mashed up approach. It didn't seem heavy because we weren't doing the heavy stuff for two whole hours. We were chopping it up.
This seems to me not so much blended learning or as learning mashup. Mashup learning, perhaps. But I wonder how much of this is transferable. Was it just a case that this was a course about audio and video and that all the students liked this sort of technology, so it naturally suited them? Could any of this be transferred to other areas of learning, I wondered?
I mean, I think in this case, it suits this cohort and this subject ideally. But I think there's certainly elements that can be transferable across many.
And what are those elements?
Well, at the moment, I'm currently redesigning our entrepreneurial management workshops for a cohort of about 160 and taking a very sort of Web 2 approach there as well, purely in thinking about how we can use YouTube. There's, one of my initial sort of instructions was to get hold of some very expensive management videos to show the students. And I thought, well, hang on, this is going to be difficult. So I looked on YouTube, spent a couple of days on YouTube. I found some amazing resources on there. I also found some dire resources on there. So what I've now done is remodeled all the modules, and each week they'll have like two or three trigger videos that are on YouTube, so they can watch them in their leisure at their own time. But also, this great little thing on YouTube, which is the related videos box on the right-hand side, you maybe get, you know, 12 or 20 related videos. So bringing that into it, getting the students to check out the ones on the related videos side and critically appraise them. And so not only are they practicing sort of critically appraising entrepreneurial theories, because there's no one unifying theory for entrepreneurship, but also it's getting used to that idea of sort of digital information literacy. You know, there's some great material out there, there's also a lot of rubbish. I can see what I see for my reasons, but I think it's really valuable if you go and explore and then we talk about it. So that's one way where I think, you know, things could be really powerful. So I think that, in terms of subject-specific delivery, it's hard to say until you actually see what is being taught or learned. But I do believe that so many of these principles or methods that I've explored can definitely be used in other areas.
Now, I was working to my own agenda here, and I was trying to push Helen into coming up with an alternative list of design principles, but she wasn't having anything of it. No, she said, I'm not even asking myself that question. It's difficult because to me that automatically implies some level of prescription. So I put it another way. Helen, I said, let's not call them design principles then, because that's probably me being prescriptive. But do you think you could got some ideas that you put forward to other teachers about ways to design programmes?
I took a session on our PG Cert, the postgraduate teaching certificate last week, which is just lecturers that do it, and sort of presented it to them, and the response there was brilliant. You know, and these are people that are lecturers, and they were kind of like, wow, we get told that we can use these things, but we'd never really realised how, you know. So I mean, it's not particularly highbrow stuff. It's just very practical examples of how these things can be used. And I mean, that whole thing about, as you say, teaching about Web 2, using Web 2, I think it's contextualising things, it's situatedness and authenticity. Away from the actual content and delivery, I mean, one of my big sort of passions in terms of teaching and learning is definitely the motivation and emotion. But, you know, why are our learners here? Why do they want to learn? And one thing that I've noticed, and it's a very simple thing, but if you give your learners an example to back up, a case to back up an example that has appeared in the news that they're interested in the last few days, immediately they perk up. Simple as that. So, you know, in terms of talking about things like audio and video on the internet, it was great because halfway through doing this was when Radiohead released their last album and said, right, we're not going to charge them for it and see who chooses to pay. I mean, that was brilliant. So, using these kinds of examples, rather than standing there talking about the history of the legality of audio and video, you know, it's just dry, and it's dry, and it's Monday morning, and who's going to want to listen to that? You know, so it's kind of like bringing in these examples that they can relate to. You know, talking about artists that have been discovered on MySpace, and, you know, these are all things that they can personally, it strikes a chord with them. And so I think that, as a motivator, cannot be underestimated.
Okay, there you've got it. I don't think we've come up with an alternative set of design principles, but I think there's some pretty interesting things came out in this whole discussion. Helen's talking about contextualising things. She's talking about situatedness. She's talking about authenticity. She's talking about motivation, emotion, and identities. Now, if we can deliver learning programs, be they blended learning programs, be they e-learning programs, be they face-to-face programs, which develop contextualization, situatedness, authenticity, motivation, emotions, and identities, I think we're a long way on to producing convincing, successful learning and teaching. I've never seen those words written up in a handbook. I've never seen them written up as a set of principles to follow in designing. But I think this is a pretty good start to the first of what I hope will be a series of interviews around this subject. And I'm going to be looking at how other people are developing that situatedness and that motivation, that emotion. I wonder as well if the fact that Helen is using Web 2.0 tools allows far more authenticity and situatedness within her programme than programmes perhaps designed with traditional e-learning tools. I found the whole talk really interesting. I hope you did. And please, if you've got any questions or feedback, do email me, graham10@mac.com, and we can chat more about this. Short musical break. Then we'll have our extra for this programme. Yeah, so stay tuned. Okay, hope you like the music. Gonna have another short natter from me, and then we got a longer bit of music to play us out from this issue of Sounds of the Bazaar. Something I should have said in the introduction, incidentally, is that I want to support more support materials behind some of these longer interviews. So if you keep tuned to the Pontedusky website, we're going to put together a bit of a wiki resource pack around the interview with Helen, giving some links to some of the materials she'd used and giving more information, background information about that course. Okay, well, I think that's about it for this issue. As always, if there's something you'd like to see on Sounds of the Bazaar, or should I say to hear on Sounds of the Bazaar, do get in touch with me, Graham Atwell, graham10@mac.com, that's graham10@mac.com. And if you'd like to come on the programme, you don't have to come face-to-face for an interview. We can do it over Skype. Just give me an email, tell me what you'd like to talk about, and we'll see what we can do. Okay, so stay tuned. Don't forget you can get this programme on the Pontedusky website, on the Bazaar website, or through iTunes. This is Graham Atwell signing out. Sounds of the Bazaar is a Pontedusky production. It's directed by Graham Atwell and produced by Dirk Stierglitz. Sounds of the Bazaar was made in the Pontedusky studios. Sounds of the Bazaar is released under a Creative Commons Attribution License.